Also with us in the studio, I'm delighted to see him, is Richard Steen. How you doing, Rich?
Hey, Foster. It's great to be here and great not to be talking about cybersecurity for
you. That's right. We, you know, you have this question sometimes to ask, what, you know, are you a rocket scientist? And you are indeed. You got your bachelor's from the University of Michigan in engineering.
That's right.
Were you planning on, you know, like going to NASA and working
with them? Yeah, completely. But by 1982, the space shuttle had been, you know, completed and launched, as a matter of fact, that year. I went to see the launch. And but everything else out there was missiles, and I wasn't really interested in working on ICBMs. So I went into automotive industry.
That's fascinating. Now, we're going to be talking shortly with your brother, Patrick, who is based in Madison, Wisconsin, near the University of Wisconsin. And he has a small patent firm there. But he also had some patents on some the modules?
He actually has a patent on a launch trajectory.
Ah, okay.
And he's been involved in the entrepreneurial, you know, free market rocket business. So he knows a lot of the history.
And that is what we're going to be examining today, looking at Elon Musk and what he's done and the business aspect of that with, you know, Jeff Bezos kind of being in a race together. Anyway, Gary, I didn't have a chance before the program to check this with you, but do you have a tech slice for us for today?
Well, I was going to talk about a 17,000-mile-an-hour Tesla.
Yes.
And, you know, even at that speed, you know, there's not much chance of running into another car.
So, yeah, you don't have to worry about that problem. Oh, my. That was something. That just taking a poll here. Did you see the launch, Gary?
I didn't see it. I was actually had to work.
Oh, well, that's understandable. Mike, how about you?
I watched it on tape replay, but I did not see it live. But I did see the two booster rockets come and land side by side. That was pretty remarkable.
That I was just standing up at the time and just looking at. I watched the whole thing on my computer, and I was just yelling, "Holy mackerel!" I used another word, but yeah, you know, just yelling at it at the TV was because it came down like. Simultaneously, I thought it was maybe like staged, but it was boom.
Yeah, it almost looked like it was computer generated.
Yeah,
it was so precise.
It was incredible. Unfortunately, the same thing didn't happen with the main rocket. That one hit the boat or the
landing platform,
landing drone at like 200 kilometers an hour. Because
that's not good.
No, three of the four booster rockets didn't fire, or they're not the booster, but
re-entry
rockets, yeah.
Yeah.
So that little one that was left couldn't handle it, and it splattered, unfortunately. So that was like the only casualty so far we know of in that. We can talk more about that, but we're going to be discussing that coming up a little bit on the show. And we also have a conversation coming up with remember the fellow that came in and talked to us about the Christie's and the auction of the meteorites that came down on...
and they came down all the lakes.
Came down on the lake.
Yeah, near Hamburg.
Yep.
He's coming back at the beginning of the second hour. Daryl Pitt will be coming back. He's got some exciting news about what's going on with those pieces of heaven that fell to Earth. And we'll talk more about that. But in the second hour also, Kasten, we're going to tap you to talk about... Oh, he's going to talk about some help calls he gave, but also you talk with you about the Internet of Things medical. Brand new field opening up. It's very, very important. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick pause here. When we come back after that, we're going to start diving into talking about Elon Musk's launch of the Falcon Super Heavy and its implications for space exploration for our country. Back with that in just a moment on the Internet Advisor. I'm going to lay odds that, given our audience, there were many of you who, like I, in 1965, watched spellbound as man stepped on the moon for the first time. And you may have, like I, for the earlier part of the 60s, followed the launch of the various vehicles that we put into space with bated breath. And you might then have also joined me on Tuesday, on your computer perhaps, watching the launch of something that is, I think, going to be rivaling that experience that we had in the 60s? We're going to talk about that right now. Let me introduce the people in our panel discussion here right now, along with the guys in studio, Ed and Kasten and Gary down in Florida. We've got Richard Steiner with us. Normally talk about cybersecurity, but he's a rocket scientist, I found out.
Yeah, and I know my dates. So the landing on the moon was in 1969. So
was it 69?
The launch was
I'm
July
sorry.
20th, because I remember it very well, and I was 10 years old. So
yeah, and I was only 5 years old when it happened, because I was born in 64. There's no way I could have remembered it when 65.
So 69, I stand corrected. All right, it was Neil Armstrong, right?
Correct.
Who jumped off, he hopped off and onto the moon. And the commentators are saying, we don't know if he's going to sink in or what's going to happen to him. But he landed, had a soft landing there. And then what was the great statement that he made?
One small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind.
That was it. Just incredibly powerful words. And I think didn't he just die recently, I think?
Yeah.
Neil Armstrong? Yeah. I think he did. But in any case, for me, there was an interesting parallel there of watching that. I happened to be, in 1969, I was doing some summer work, internship at a parish in Panama City, in the canal area there. I was actually in Panama, not in the canal zone. And we watched it on TV. And it was funny because we were watching and listening to the Spanish commentary. But behind the Spanish commentary was the English commentary going on. So we could listen in either language to what was being said and going on there.
And so in the Spanish version, did the announcer, when he landed on the moon, say, go!
Or moon! Luna! That would have been what they said.
Well, what made this launch of the Falcon Heavy so spectacular is in the internet age. People are able to watch it on YouTube. People send each other gifts of it. And that's what just makes it that much more spectacular, I think.
Patrick, I'm just curious. Patrick Steenen is also with us. I introduced him before as a patent lawyer trained in as a mining engineer, but certainly had lifted his eyes to the skies. I worked for NASA for a number of years, right, Patrick?
Actually, Lockheed.
Okay.
No, Lockheed Martin.
Okay. I was under contract to NASA?
Sometimes, but mainly worked on the submarine ballistic missile system.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Advanced Concepts, where we did do things for NASA.
Yeah. Then you also, I see that you had a patent that you got for a two-stage launch vehicle and launch trajectory method. So you moved, it seems, moved up quite a bit in the, in involvement in the rockets and in the launch vehicles themselves. To what degree was that?
Well, before I worked for Lockheed, I worked for a startup in 1981, two and parts of three. And then I tried to start my own company with a pressure-fed two-stage vehicle. And then I went to work for Lockheed. And then so I worked with Max Hunter, who was famous for getting the DCX funded.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to the ballistic missile system, and they were going to use old missiles to build an orbital system, sort of competitive with orbital sciences at the time.
Mm-hmm. And then what was this two-stage launch vehicle and launch trajectory method that you patented?
So the it's looking for the cheapest way build a launch vehicle that's totally reusable.
Uh-huh.
And so the concept is that you just launch the first stage straight up, and then you launch so it comes right back down, which is similar to what SpaceX is doing now.
Yes,
only
yes.
They have they have about 14,000 feet per second capability on the first stage, but if they don't need all their payload, they return to the launch site, but uses up a lot of propellant before they get there, and then they land.
Mm-hmm.
But they get some extra downrange velocity. But the idea is that just going up, straight up and straight down makes the first stage very recoverable, as Elon has shown.
Mm-hmm.
And then the upper stage, I worked with Gary Hudson, who was really into single stage, and that was pretty much the idea that, you know, everything should, any type of transportation should be, you know, like an airplane or a truck or something. You don't stage it. You get one vehicle to go all the way.
Yeah.
But it's always been a lot of technology too far. I mean, the most recent one, the X-33 that Lockheed tried to build, you know, they just gave up on it. So if you launch straight up and straight down, getting the upper stage into orbit is really quite easy, and you have enough payload to make the stage heavy enough so you can recover it. You have to have a heat shield around the whole stage and then, again, do a rocket landing.
Okay. And by the way, and also with us, we have Professor Greg Odegaard from the MTU up in Hancock, Michigan. And I think I've got my figures wrong. You worked for NASA for 4 years, am I right?
Before yeah, that's correct.
You worked before. Well, what role did you play there at NASA when you were working with them?
We did some research on composite materials. So at the time, we were trying to help develop the technology. It's been around for a few decades, but it's been slowly evolving and improving over time, and so that's what I was working on while I was there, and that's also what I've been working on since I left and came to Michigan Tech.
Mm-hmm. How does that fit in with the launch vehicles?
Well, actually, on Tuesday, when the Falcon Heavy went up, the a lot of the rocket structure is made out of composite materials, which is, if you're not too familiar with composite materials, they're very lightweight.
Yep.
They're lighter than metal, lighter than aluminum, with similar stiffness and strength. So, of course, the lighter the structure is of the rocket, the further it can go, and the less fuel it may have to burn, or the greater payload it can bring up. And so that's one of the technologies that SpaceX has been taking advantage of in some of their recent achievements, including what we saw on Tuesday.
Yes, and matter of fact, your institute is called the STRI, the Institute for Ultra-Strong Composites by Computational Design. That's the project that you're running right now, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And so the focus of that is that we're trying to develop the next generation of composite materials. So what we saw on the Falcon Heavy and what we see also in a lot of modern aircraft, like the Boeing 787, those are state-of-the-art composite materials. However, if we want to be able to get people to Mars, we need something even lighter and stronger than that. And so that's what we've been charged with by NASA, is to develop the next generation of super lightweight, strong composite materials.
Hey, Greg, this is Richard. Don't they blame the Falcon 9's composite material for the explosion they had on the pad when evidently the liquid oxygen froze and somehow combined with the carbohydrates that were in the composite?
I can add a little something to that. So in order to pressurize the tanks, they need helium, which they heat up. But they store it inside a tank, inside the liquid oxygen tank. And so to make these tanks strong, they use a graphite composite fibers.
Patrick, hang on a second. We're going to take the music behind us, and we're coming up to a break. And when we come on the other side, we'll have plenty of time to talk some more about this. I'm anxious to get your perspective on the battle for Mars. Welcome back. We're talking about, with a group of people who are very familiar with the subject, the whole notion of getting into outer space. And we're kind of dissecting the Falcon Super Heavy liftoff this last week and successful landing of the two first stage rockets. The booster, apparently, the main booster, didn't do quite as well. It hit the ground at about 200 kilometers an hour. In any case, let me reintroduce the people who are with us. Richard Steenen in studio, a rocket scientist, we find out as well. And then we also have Patrick Steenen, his brother, patent lawyer, but also trained has a patent on a two-stage launch vehicle and launch trajectory method. And then Professor Greg Odegaard is with us as well from Michigan Technological University. He was a professor of computational mechanics up there, and they're looking into building the new, the next generation of lightweight but very strong composite materials that will be able to take a bigger vessel up into space and to Mars. Patrick, can you wrap up kind of quickly? You were giving an explanation. Your brother had asked, you know, why was there the explosion of the, was it SpaceX?
That was a Falcon 9. About a year ago.
Yeah. And you were giving an explanation of that, if you could kind of wrap it up.
Okay. So in order to pressurize the tank, they store the helium within the oxygen tank. And in order to make that tank lighter, they use a metal liner and then they wrap it with carbon fibers. And when they froze, the carbon fibers, there was a little oxygen got between the metal and the liners, it seems, and then the oxygen there can combine with the carbon, and it did, and blew up. And so all that gas got released, and that overpressurized the tank, so the tank burst. And since there's already a little fire going there, everything blew up.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, let's talk about, gentlemen, I want to see if anybody just kind of jump into the conversation, Kasten and Ed as well. When I was watching the 60s, NASA was the hero. They were the ones that were getting people on the moon, and it looked like it was all guns ahead, and then suddenly it just kind of dropped off. And now, you know, a period of 30, 40 years later, suddenly private venture is taking over from this. Where's NASA in all of this now?
Well, you know, my own personal opinion, this is Ed, and, you know, you have to remember what was happening in the 80s. We were in the midst of the Cold War. Most of the funding was probably going into the military for defense, and they were pulling it away from NASA at that point, and they never really got it back, but that's just my opinion.
Hmm.
Yeah, and it was kind of the beginning. After we landed on the moon, we just kept going back. You remember
all
of the talk of it was, to me, it was almost an anti-science time. We don't need to go there. It's just a waste of money. And frankly, they were spending a lot of money. I mean, just tremendous, tremendous budgets. And everything was so well engineered. There were, you know, triply redundant designs for every single component on the Saturn V. And it wasn't until they came to the final design decision that they said, okay, this one works best. We're going to go with it. So they really took an amazing approach. Fast forward to now, we've got the internet. We've got geospatial imaging of the Earth, you know, Google Earth. We've got all these applications for communication and Earth resources that people have to get satellites up there for. Supposedly, SpaceX has a launch manifest that includes 50 launches.
Wow.
Already booked, and people are making progress payments on them.
You know, I was looking at something, a chart that showed the weight and the thrust of the different vehicles, and the Falcon Heavy, $105 million, right? And the Saturn V was it $1.2 billion? It's just incredible numbers for the launches.
Yeah, for each launch. That's why you can see Elon thinking, hey, we should reuse those things. It's
exactly. And I think, Patrick, were you talking about that being an issue? The reuse is, I mean, even back earlier days, the whole issue of reusing the stages is a very important one.
Yeah, I mean, they were thinking about reuse. Von Braun thought about it in the late 40s. But the problem with reuse is that it's tough to do. And you know, NASA, we beat the Russians. That was the big thing. And then, you know, we really Nixon just sort of in '68 they just pulled the funding for, you know, there was a nuclear rockets. We were going to go to Mars by '76. There just wasn't any real call for that. We didn't. Those were sort of contingent that if the Russians beat us to the moon, well, we'd have to do the next thing. So, you know, over the last 40 years, there's been numerous attempts to bring down the cost of space launch. But this time, we have Elon, who is an amazing figure, of course. But he's also been funded right from almost from the get-go, even before he launched the first time into orbit. NASA was funding him. And they did fund most of the development of the Falcon 9. But, you know, they said he developed the vehicle, which would have cost them $5 billion. He did it for $500 million. And they thought maybe if they had used, you know, better contracting parameters, they might have gotten it down to $2.5 billion. So he's really changed the paradigm by showing that you can build, you can do the engineering and build the vehicles. The whole development cost can be reduced by a factor of 10. But NASA is, you know, heavily involved with both the technology, okay, like the heat shield on the Dragon capsule, but also in funding these things. And Elon has said that, you know, he's expecting to, you know, they're spending $90 million to launch each astronaut. If NASA will pay him that to launch the astronauts, that will give him the funding to build, you know, the big F booster, and go to Mars. But
Professor Odegaard, you could start the comment on this. What do you make of the race that's going? Apparently, some of what's propelling this thing too is Jeff Bezos from Amazon, who's got a ton of money, has a Blue Origin project, and it looks like he's racing, you know, to build the next really big rocket. I forget the name of the rocket, but
yeah, the rocket's called the New Glenn.
That's right.
It's beautiful. It's spectacular. It's kind of nice to see images of it on the on their website. Yes, and there's a lot of people who feel that really part of the driving for this, for the Falcon Heavy and the launch, and also with the pushing of the next generation of SpaceX rockets, that's really being driven by Jeff Bezos' company and their efforts. One thing I want to kind of add to the conversation, Patrick made a very good point that it's kind of easy to forget about NASA in here. You know, back in the late 60s and early 70s, they did some very high-profile things with some of those missions, and we haven't heard a lot of from them as far as high-profile missions over the last few decades, but certainly a lot of that technology used that we see SpaceX using and Blue Origin, a lot of that technology comes from decades of work at the different NASA centers and other companies and government agencies as well. So that's really one of the important things that NASA is really contributing is the support, that basic research on a lot of that enabling technology.
As we were traveling here, I think it was Ed was telling me about the Saturn V, was that the name? Yeah, the rocket that went up there. Mm-hmm. That they have been trying to go back and find out. In other words, there's been some information lost, I think.
Well, I remember hearing and reading about 5-8 years ago when this whole SpaceX thing started, that a lot of engineers had to go back to the museums to look at how the Saturn V and the valves and things were created. You're nodding your head, Richard.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I read that too.
Yep.
So then it's incredible because when technology was lost, because that's really this BFR, big friggin' rocket that Elon is putting up. It could benefit, I would think, so much from the Saturn V rocket. But
they did take some of them out of storage and fire them. So they have tested them recently. But there is this problem, you know, like United Launch Alliance buys engines from the Russians. And right at the beginning, the Air Force said, you know, we want you to be able to build these. The Russians have to give you the plans. And they did give us the plans. But we're not Russians, so we don't have all the little details. So a very good set of plans, you know, could be done, but there'd be a lot of, you know, learning just exactly, you know, and you have to test everything to make sure that it does what it says. And so it's difficult to go back. I mean, not that they couldn't redesign the F1 engine or you know, re-engineer it. And they've done that with the J2, which was the upper stage engine. They took those out of storage, and they were looking at using them on the Orion program.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they spent some money and came up with a new variant that uses modern materials, fewer parts, and is cost, you know, reasonably cost.
So, do you think which of the two companies do you think is going to make it to the launch pad first? The New Glenn or the BFR?
They're both, you know, using, designing and working on testing these stage combustion engines like the Russians.
Yeah.
And so a stage combustion engine, they burn all of one of the propellants with some of the other. So they get hot gas, but not too hot. And it gives them a lot of power to raise the pressure. Mm-hmm. And that's very important for first stage engines. But they are tricky, and they, you know, like the shuttle main engine was of that type, and took years to get great reliability from it. So I'm thinking they'll probably eventually have their engines. I'm not sure how fast.
All right. Gentlemen, I want to thank you. We've just kind of scratched the surface on this, but it's been fun. Thanks so much again to Patrick Sneeden for being with us and to Professor Greg Odegaard as well for joining us from MTU up there. Gentlemen, thank you for being part of the conversation. Richard, of course, you're sticking around in the studio as well. We'll be back in just a minute with Mike.